Hey folks, welcome to the show. Hey Sharad, how's it going, man?
It's going very well, can't complain. Other than seems like we're back to square one in terms of how COVID's treating us, but just staying strong, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like almost an era has gone by. Mm-hmm. But you know, to be fair, I was just checking the numbers today in the morning. It's only been probably last 30 days is when the actual accelerated spike
yeah.
has come in.
Yeah.
And I recall it was, I think, 6th of February when I messaged you that, dude, like the 7-day average is picking up.
Yeah.
What do you think? An uptick coming?
Yeah.
So, it's been mainly since, I think, last week of March.
Yeah.
Since things have actually kind of gone out of control numbers-wise.
And yeah.
On ground level, things were already...
But you're right. It seems like a generation-long affair, right?
Yeah. And today it's going to be an interesting chat. We are going to... talk with Amit Ramani. He was the founder and CEO of Office Space Solutions. And Amit, definitely, you know, we think you will be in a hot seat right now. You kind of run a workspace solutions company, and we are in the middle of a second wave of the pandemic. And naturally, you know, the biggest question that is there when it comes to the commercial real estate segment is, that, you know, there are kind of three models out there, right, which people talk about all the time. One is that, okay, it's going to be 100% work from home, so it's going to be Armageddon for anyone who operates a commercial RE business. The other scenario is that, no, it's going to be like a hybrid model going forward where, you know, you would have a blend of work from home plus a kind of different nature of office spaces out there, you know, with design and layout modifications. And then there is a third perspective which says that because globally everyone is going more and more work from home, the services value chain of India will get a major boost thanks to that. And as a result of that, a lot of, you know, offshore business is coming our way, which will eventually lead to a big amount of utilization from the perspective of office spaces. So, no, welcome to the show, Amit. And would love to, you know, kind of start the chat by hearing your high-level view on where we are headed amongst these three models.
So, Nikhil and Sharad, thanks for having me over. Clearly, I think having seen some of this in play out in when 9/11 happened in a very small way in 2001 in the US, right? The first reaction is, let me go and, you know, everybody works from home, right? Obviously, it's a very small event in terms of as a comparison to what's happening with currently with the pandemic. But if you see, you know, the first wave happened, right, which was kind of started subsiding somewhere, I would say, post Diwali. And you could clearly see that people wanted to come back. As a result, the occupancy in majority of, be it conventional offices or, co-working flex spaces started going up, physical occupancy, right? And till about March, I would say the average occupancy that we were seeing in our centers was trending between 30 to 70%,
mm-hmm.
right, physically. Mm-hmm. Now, clearly, I think that tells me that people want to come back. So it's not the first option, everybody's going to work from home, I think is a short-term measure. I don't think it's going to work long-term.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few factors. One, obviously, there's a fear factor that's come in with the second variant coming into play. Second, the biggest challenge is that people have kids at home. Kids can't go to school, and as a result, parents are somewhat challenged in terms of, you know, completely working from home. And my perspective overall is that the hybrid model is probably the only model that can, stay in the long term, because a couple of reasons. One, the employees have now tasted the value of ability to work from home or work near home.
Yeah,
and that extra 2-3 hours of commute is not giving anybody any productive time, right?
Yeah.
So clearly the hybrid model where a base will get established at a central location, a certain portion will work near home, and then a certain portion will permanently work from home is probably the only model that I think will work in the long term.
This is, very interesting because didn't we have Manoj Kalra? Recently, he heads global business support at Royal DSM, and he looks at all the offshore operations of Royal DSM Group, which is a Netherlands-based quote-unquote science company.
They do
a lot of things, you know,
nutrition and
supplements
science.
To I don't know what not. And he had a very similar perspective that, you know, for me, the biggest boon that has come out of this is that, you know, the labor market has suddenly expanded I can now, you know, geography, like we are based out of Hyderabad. So, you know, I don't need to attract talent based out of Hyderabad. I can easily, you know, set up like a satellite office in some small town and hire someone there and then make sure that that guy has a local optionality to walk in whenever he or she requires. Amit, that's a very kind of there's obviously a lot of parallels between what you said and what Manoj was commenting on, but it does at a basic level change the entire, I would say, layout slash design slash space specification end of things, right? For any shared workspace. What are your thoughts on that?
And it's I'm going to listen to this quite keenly because I think both of you have degrees in architecture here.
I do have a degree in architecture, Amit. Yes, I forgot about that completely.
So I think, at least from a design perspective, I think it starts out with the building selection. Because I think earlier when, you know, people were looking at the whole workspace, the building quality did not make that much of a difference to start with, right? For majority of the players, I'm not talking about the large MNCs, they were always in the grade A plus kind of category. Today, the building quality is as important as the workspace quality that one builds. Right. So clearly, that's where it starts. What kind of factors is the building management taking into the cognizance of how do they manage the building? What is the basic HVAC system, the air conditioning system that exists in the building? Is there filtration in the building? Is there air quality controls in the building? So that's one part of it. Second, how does the lift efficiency work, right? What is the ventilation system that the overall building is putting in place? So many of these factors, which we were looking into prior, but I think have become at front and center. Then coming to the workspace design itself, I think it comes in three elements. One, what is the change in terms of physicality? So clearly, we have done all the social distancing norms, trying to make sure that 6 feet distances are maintained, reduced our occupancy in our meeting rooms, reduced the occupancy in our collaboration zones or the activity-based settings where, you know, you're trying to keep people apart and so on. So I think there are design interventions that have come in the common areas. Then there are design interventions that have come into dedicated areas where people take on space and mm-hmm. their dedicated workspace, mm-hmm. Wherein obviously 6 foot distance. So obviously a bit of de-densification has happened, almost about 20% de-densification has happened to accommodate some of these physical changes in the workspace itself. Then coming to the second part is the health and hygiene, right? So how frequently do you manage the space? What interventions have we been able to do on the air conditioning system? Is there a fresh air system installed in the building? Are there UV controls in the space so that sanitization happens, some automatically, some in terms of higher frequency by deploying housekeeping staff, etc.? So some of those measures have already been instituted now in many of our centers, and many of my colleagues and competitors in the space are doing similar things. Mm-hmm. The third is the technology intervention, which I think is a big one. Because with technology intervention, what has happened is at the workspace level, we've been able to manage almost a touchless experience. So right. As an example, we have our own app, which basically is integrated with Arogya Setu. So anything, do you have a vaccine already? Have you been in touch with? How safe are you? Is all integrated through our access control system, which is all touchless. All ordering within our system, which could be food, beverage, etc., is all touchless. Even our meeting room access is through a touchless system. You scan and you get in. And even in the meeting room, what we've been able to do after people use the space, automatically the UV controls come into play. A system comes into play that basically sanitizes it on the fly, and till that point nobody can access the meeting room. So a lot of controls have been put from a technology standpoint, and mm-hmm. that's helping in a big way. All our, for example, our housekeeping, security, and pantry team members are now all controlled through a central app where they're putting what's been the frequency of their hygiene, what's been the frequency of the systems that are been in control. Mm-hmm. So many of these interventions are from a design and technology standpoint that have made a big difference in giving the safety. So for example, we today run a survey every month on our COVID readiness, and I will tell you that if we get less than a 9 on 10, then there are serious issues with those center managers. So we have put a lot of focus on making sure that not only what we are doing is in place to ensure the safety of our members, but also what is the perception of our members when they are coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So these are a few things that we have done to ensure that these are established in this post-COVID world.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You know, on the business side, right? Like, I mean, typically when co-working sort of sprang up about, 4 or 5 years back when they were really hot, I mean, they still are, but they were very startup centric. They catered to a startup crowd. They catered to the entrepreneur. That was the mindset. That was the typical tenants as well. Do you see that trend shifting now? Like when Nikhil was talking about satellite offices, that's a conversation that we had with Mr. Manoj, who was saying that, he was comparing it to a library. Like, even if you can study at home, you still offer a library, because if you want to, similarly, as an employer, you need to offer the availability in office. In that context, right, I mean, do you think co-working sort of has to move away from just startups and look at increasingly as setups for big offices and MNCs as well?
Sharath, I think, again, every co-working has a bit of a different model. There are basically three types of co-working that exist today globally, right? One who are primarily focused on startups and freelancers. There are a few examples in India. Then there are players like us, which basically swim between B2C and B2B.
Mm-hmm.
So a portion of our business comes from what I would call as freelancers, startups, smaller enterprises, and then mid-sized enterprises, and then large MNCs and large-scale enterprise customers, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a third model which purely focuses on large enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they're only focused on, they don't cater to the B2C demand. Now, at least the way we have envisioned the company from day one, we were a B2C and a B2B kind of a business. Today, almost 60% of our business comes from enterprise clients, about 25% from mid-sized to SMEs,
mm-hmm.
and then about 15% from startups and freelancers. Now, interestingly enough, when COVID hit, the first wave hit, the first guys who left us were the startups and the freelancers and the smaller cohort sizes, less than 25 seats, right?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
their lock-ins were lower, or maybe they didn't have a lock-in and they left the
fastest. Mm-hmm.
They came back the fastest. And, mm-hmm. Clearly, because we were swimming in the B2C and the B2B business, we actually got least impacted out of all our competitors.
Yeah.
And the reason was that the guy who takes 2 seats with you has very little leverage to negotiate on price. The guy who takes 200 seats will negotiate the last penny out of it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So in our firm belief is that, clearly the startup, if your business is only on startup and freelancers, there's a problem. If your business is only on large-scale enterprises, there's again a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But if you swim between, then there is a successful business model to me.
Interesting, like you mentioned, you talked about price. I mean, I also wanted to kind of get your sense on, obviously, from a design or layout perspective, just taking into account social distancing norms, capacity must have been hit to a certain extent. One is in terms of utilization, and the other is just in terms of how many people you can actually, accommodate. Does the reduction in capacity / utilization, to what extent did it get negated or hedged by any kind of a pricing control or leverage that players like you have? I mean, what's your kind of take on that?
So Nikhil, I think at least our approach has been a bit different. So I really can't comment on overall in the industry, but almost 65% of our portfolio is in partnership with the landlord. So when times are great, we both make, a decent amount of return. When times are not so great, we both share in a bit of a pain, right? So last 1 year, obviously, we had some challenges in terms of occupancy. Obviously, as I mentioned, people left. And as a result, obviously, the returns become smaller for that short period. I think in terms of pricing overall, the de-densification is kind of now being priced into the ultimate price that is being offered to the customer, right? Because if I have to increase, let's say, or decrease my density, right, in this scenario, then certainly I'll be able to fit less number of seats. At the end of the day, the real estate business is square footage driven, right? Everything boils down to the amount of square footage that you occupy.
Mm-hmm.
So pricing has taken a bit of a beating. I would say it's somewhere around 10 to 12% has been reduced. But I think most customers are smart enough to understand that even if they went to a conventional space, right? If they took their own space, the de-densification will have the same impact that they're having in a co-working one. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But if they go with a conventional space, they are locked in for anywhere between 5 to 6 years. They have to put in their own capital. There is no flexibility. And they can't scale up and down at a very short notice. So everybody understands that when it comes to de-densification, it's the same scenario. I take my own space or I take co-working.
Sure.
But the other flexibility that comes on with co-working is certainly seeing a trend more towards co-working. Yes, pricing is a bit of a pressure. As I said, 10-12% has been.
But like interesting, like are customers also like open to paying a premium for the, you know, because of COVID, effectively, like you were mentioning that internally, you had to do a lot of changes, right? So be it from HVAC systems to digitizing a lot of the access. Is there at the moment an appetite to place a premium on it? Or it's too early to make a trend out of it?
No, so I think one thing, Nikhil, which was becoming very clear, even before COVID, was that customers were gravitating towards branded players.
Right.
Second, they were gravitating towards a player which had a large network, because they were already thinking of, you know, what if I need 10 seats in Ahmedabad? What if I need 10 seats in Kurla and I'm based out of Lower Parel? So from that standpoint, already a shift had started happening. It has fast-tracked that shift right now, where a non-branded player is certainly going to have a challenge. People will be willing to pay a premium for the branded player,
right?
Not because just because of our, you know, purely because of our brand, but because we have a network, because the like-minded customers are there, like-minded enterprise customers are there. We are in grade A, A-minus type buildings. The quality is better. We are near public transportation. All the things that go into a great location and a great infrastructure is available today with a branded player. It's not available with a non-branded player. And clearly, for us, I think it is very important that customer comes first. And once our customer, we have the highest net promoter score in the country for the last 3 years, almost 80% points, higher than even some of the large you know, hotel chains. So that clearly is a visible difference, which the customer will pay a premium and will be willing to take on, you know, a more branded player.
No, in terms of sort of the revenue models, I mean, obviously for the bigger portfolio where you have MNCs and the bigger companies, for them, I guess the straight lease sort of works. But for some of the smaller companies, are you seeing like, I mean, evolution in revenue models, like revenue share or equity investment into the company, like, or is it typically all been like straight lease payments?
So,
because we've seen some of that in the West.
So again, from day one,
yeah,
we were focused on doing partnership with the landlords, which was revenue share or a profit share kind of a model, right? Mm-hmm. Now, our premise was that if you have to offer the flexibility to the community or our tenant,
yeah,
then somebody will have to carry that additional risk.
Sure.
And our pitch always to our partner landlords is that a co-working is like a cafe or a crash or a gym in your facility.
Mm-hmm.
Because today, as a co-working player, I can offer 2 seats, I can offer 200 seats, right?
Yeah.
I can offer it for 1 day, I can offer it for 5 years. As a developer, you cannot give that flexibility, but the customer today demands that flexibility. So please partner with me, even in your 1 million square foot portfolio, give me 20,000 square feet, which doesn't impact you because you do similar things to provide amenities in your building. And that pitch really worked. And today, that's why I'm telling you, out of the 72 odd properties that are operational, 40 plus are in partnership with the landlord.
Okay.
Where I don't carry any straight lease risk.
Yeah.
Right. We're probably the only player globally that has been able to crack that model.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are other people who will try and come and do similar things.
Mm-hmm.
Most players, when they go in the market today, they want to take on 100, 200, 300,000 square feet. Now, at that stage, nobody is going to take a bet of revenue share or
yeah.
profit share with you. Because that's the whole building he has. I am talking to my partners for 20,000, 30,000 square feet out of a 500,000 square feet,
right.
Which is the risk people are willing to take. Now, our model is very different. That's why we were always a distributed network, 70 plus locations, 12 cities, all of those things which have worked for us.
Mm-hmm.
It is all being proven out today. But
mm-hmm.
I think models will shift
mm-hmm.
because for people to carry that risk on their own of that flexibility is going to be a very hard challenge to overcome as things evolve.
Yeah. And, you know, like you talked about 12 cities. So what is, how do you know, in terms of near-term or mid-term outlook, do you sort of see yourself growing horizontally and, you know, from 12 to 14 to 16 to 20 and sort of go through and cover more pockets which you identify? Or is it sort of strengthening your presence in these 12 outlets and sort of build on those and penetrate deeper? How do you think about sort of future growth?
So clearly, these seven metros drive today about 85% of the total commercial demand in this country,
okay.
Right? So which is Delhi, Mumbai, Bangalore, Hyderabad, Pune, Chennai, Kolkata, and then obviously Noida and Gurgaon as a part of the NCR network, right? We are currently in two tier two cities, Ahmedabad and Chandigarh. We have signed on Indore. So we have about three, I would say, tier two cities where we are operational, just about to be operational.
Mm-hmm.
We will add Kochi, we will add Jaipur, we will add Lucknow this year. And clearly, there is going to be both horizontal and vertical expansion.
Okay.
Now, from a horizontal standpoint, we will probably limit ourselves to 16, 17 cities because it is also dependent on the kind of infrastructure that's available, right? Now, if you go to a city where there is no internet, roads are not there, education infrastructure is not there, I can't open up a center and suddenly imagine that is limited probably to 16, 17 cities in this country. In terms of verticality, we our model is a bit different. So in every micro market, so let's take Bandra Kurla, or let's take Lower Parel, or let's take Andheri East in a city like Mumbai, we will have 4 to 8 centers of 20 to 25,000 square feet each in each of these micro markets,
mm-hmm.
right? Today, we are at about 40,000 odd seats operational. December 2022, we'll touch 80,000 seats.
Okay.
We were averaging about 5,000 seat additional every year.
Mm-hmm.
We have added close to, in the last 18 months, we would have added close to about 60,000, or almost 50,000 additional seats.
Yeah. And, you know, like, there are a bunch of players now, like, there's co-working, there's WeWork, there's Office, obviously, and there's 91 Springboard. Like, there are a bunch of players, right? Regus as well. Do you see any consolidation in the sector yet, or do you think it's, like, very early right now? Everyone's in aggressive growth and expansion phase right now, but eventually there has to be some kind of consolidation.
So, in all honesty, you know, pre-COVID, there were some 250, 300 co-working players.
Yeah.
Some of that consolidation already happened, you know. Now, out of the top 25, there are probably 5 or 6 large players left in the market, right? Consolidation amongst them is very hard because all of us have a very large footprint. Plus, you know, similar to any other industry, right? Obviously, co-working being a sunrise industry. You know, there is not going to be just one bank, right? There's not going to be just one automobile.
Sure, yeah.
The market is so large. We're talking about a billion square foot commercial real estate growing at an average of about, you know, about 3 to 5% every year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just in the sheer numbers, it's not possible for one player to command, you know, the complete, you know, ecosystem. It's a physical asset business at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It's not like I can have warehouses and it's not an e-commerce play, right?
Yeah, so which is
clearly there is a physicality to it, and any physical business will have multiple, and in fact, competition is good.
Yeah.
It values the offering that one has. So I think at the top level, consolidation will not happen. At some of the smaller scale level, automatic elimination will happen more than consolidation.
It's interesting you use the word e-commerce, because I was just reading that there is a little bit of a strategic play there that you guys are sort of doing right now in terms of, you know, office furniture kind of a thing. What's your thought process there?
So, Sharad, I think, you know, when wave one hit, right?
Yeah.
Same time last year, there was paranoia, right? And I was paranoid, and hence my company was paranoid that what will happen, you know, in the future. So we launched multiple products in that whole journey. And of that, one product that we launched was Office at Home, which basically said that I will give you a ergonomic chair and a smart desk at your place, and I'll give it to you on a subscription basis. It will give you access to my nearest center to do your concierge services, printing, etc., receive your packages, and so on and so forth, right? So that actually started working fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
And we, till date, have sold about close to about 3,000 desks, both in subscription and one-time sales. Now, we were using platforms such as Amazon, Flipkart, etc., to do some of those sales. Now, what we thought was that today, as an offering, right, we offer a great environment in our centers. You see some of the images behind me right now, right? Why can't I translate that back into a home office or a small medium office for somebody who only wants to buy, let's say, a furniture or a chair or loose furniture or the collaboration zone furniture and so on?
Yeah.
So we launch all those products at shop.office.com.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically is our e-commerce play,
yeah.
Which is integrated obviously with our logistics partners. And we now deliver through that platform to both our current members as well as the future potential members, because we also have the strength of having a showroom, right? Technically, all my 70 plus centers today going on to 100 are my showrooms, right? So just like you go to a, you know, not everything can be bought on e-commerce, right? You need to you know, touch and feel that sofa before you buy it.
Mm-hmm.
The same logic applies. You won't buy a you know, 10,000 rupee chair without testing it. And each of our locations becomes that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our play on, you know, that whole e-commerce platform. And again, initial results, which obviously we just launched about a month back, are very, very encouraging.
No, fascinating. That's quite interesting.
You know, Amit, I just also want to talk to you a bit about capital. I mean, like, you guys are obviously Sequoia backed. So obviously on capital side, there are, you know, two aspects, right? One is obviously in terms of pure equity plays at a corporate level. And the other is, you know, there is a lot of interest and entry of foreign capital within commercial RE, especially in the grade A listed space through, you know, especially for leased assets through real estate investment trusts. You know, we hear big funds, be it Brookfields, be it Blackstone, who are, you know, very quickly consolidating huge leased assets into their portfolio. And it's very interesting because as an investor, obviously physical real estate has gone through its own set of challenges, but you know, kind of REITs convert that physical footfall into a financial product, which to those who understand and like it can be fairly interesting. So what's your you know, how do you see that entire REIT space evolve? And don't you think that the entire REIT space also might have some sort of a impact on consolidation or you know, just kind of pooling of capital into scaled opportunities, maybe only in the grade A space? And also from a venture capital perspective, like, I'm sure, like, as soon as you said that, you know, a large part of your properties are in a profit share or a revenue share model with landlords, it's obviously an asset light model, right? Which VCs admire. How do you see, you know, a VCs perspective evolve? Do you see them actually go for, you know, capex heavy models in the future? You think it's going to stay opex oriented asset light models that they're going to enjoy?
So I think a couple of different points. So let me take the...
Too many. Sorry, I just went into a...
So I'll take the REIT part first and then the VC part, because they both behave very differently.
Yeah.
Right? Anytime there is a corporatization of any industry, it's always good, right? Because if I look at commercial real estate 25 years ago, you know, you could open up a commercial office in any building you wanted, residential, commercial, it didn't matter, right?
Hmm.
Today, I can assure you, if you have a 10% team or more, you can only operate out of a commercial space. And it's happened because of the bylaws in most major cities have been very strictly enforced to the effect where corporatization has happened, which also the IT/ITS boom bought the whole journey of people looking for grade A plus assets. And that's where Bangalore, Mumbai, many other cities saw some great buildings coming up with some great assets, and obviously developers becoming much more focused on delivering the end product. I think the REIT is the natural progression of that next step. So when you take great assets, you want to diversify your risk in Bandra Kurla versus your risk in Koramangala. And you can only do that if you bring a portfolio together,
mm-hmm.
and also bring the ability of the shareholders, right? Which for most people to buy a 20, 30, 40 crore asset is a pipe dream, but to buy shares in a REIT is very easy. It's so overall, I think it is a great thing for the industry that the REIT has come in. In terms of your other point on consolidation, some of that consolidation has already happened. You look at any commercial metro, right? Today, I can tell you on your fingers, you can count the top four or five developers in that city.
Right.
Right. Which clearly has demarcated the premium that they command and the premium that is not commanded by, let's say, great VC type developers, right? So that institutionalization is happening, and I think it's a brilliant thing for the industry. It will only help make real estate assets much more quality oriented. Tenants will have a much better offering. The tenants will have a much better choice, right? So I think REIT is a great thing for the company. Second, coming back to the VC part of it, VCs work in a very different mindset, right? They are typically wanting to come in early and they want to invest, and then they want an alpha on that return, right? Which is not what a REIT expects. REIT is happy with a 8% yield on a rental property.
Yeah.
A VC is looking for a 5x, 10x, 20x kind of a return. Now, a 5x, 10x, 20x return cannot happen when you look at a fixed asset or a capital heavy asset, because those assets, I'm not talking about anomaly kind of scenario, but in a typical historic way, they will only appreciate, 5-10% on a year-on-year basis. Your rental income will go typically 5% year-on-year, so on and so forth. So it can never get into a 10x, 20x. It can only get 10x, 20x if you flip it on its side and you make it completely asset heavy. If you are continuing to make an asset-heavy investment, and there are different funds that focus on that, and they do a phenomenal job. We have examples. You took a few names just before this. A VC is always looking for an alpha, and that alpha can only come when your risk is mitigated, your investment is stretched quite a bit, and you can have a fast-track growth that doesn't grow 20% year-on-year, grows 200, 300% year-on-year.
I think by the anomaly, you meant WeWork, right? I'm just kidding.
I didn't say anything.
No, I did. I'm just kidding. Yeah. No, thanks a lot, Amit. This was super fascinating. And I mean, your personal journey has also been very fascinating. As Sharad correctly pointed out, that you're an architect by training from SPA. And from there, you obviously went to Cornell, and then you kind of went deep into the business world with one venture after another. I'm also an architect by training, which I don't throw around a lot. So that was a common thing, which unfortunately we don't have much of a time to dwell upon. But it's been great chatting with you, Amit. What about what
yeah,
you said?
No, it was a good chat. Learned a lot, and it's always fun to shoot the breeze with guys who are running businesses in different sectors. So appreciate you taking the time out. Good luck. And we'll obviously be sort of looking at the business and be supportive in whichever way we can.
So Nikhil and Sharad, thank you for your time. It's been a great pleasure to have the opportunity to chat here. Look forward to keep in touch.
Oh no, perfect. No, thank you so much, Amit. And yeah, this was great, and we'll be back soon and with another exciting guest. It should be fun. What do you say, Sharad?
Yeah, I'm looking forward.
So yeah, this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off.